Welcome back to Counting to Five, a podcast about the United States Supreme Court. In this episode, we're going to review a couple of decisions the court has issued in the last few weeks, but first let's talk briefly about where we are in the term and what the court's been up to lately. We've reached the busiest time of the year for court watchers, because the court's long-standing practice is to issue all of its decisions for the term before the court goes into recess at the beginning of July. The 6 weeks or so leading up to the end of June are always the heaviest time of year for opinions. This year is no different. On Monday, May 22nd, the court issued decisions in three cases. The following week, on Tuesday, May 30th, the court announced another four decisions, and this week, on Monday, June 5th, the court issued four more decisions. This brings the total decided cases for the term up to 43, which still leaves us with another 21 outstanding decisions expected by the end of June, or about seven decisions a week for the next 3 weeks. The court is scheduled to take the bench the next three Mondays to announce decisions, but based on past practice, the court will likely also add one or more additional opinion dates, typically on Thursdays later in June. But there's no way of knowing when the decision in any given case will come down until that opinion is actually announced. Of the 11 decisions handed down in the last 3 weeks, fully eight of them have been unanimous, including all four of this Monday's decisions, which is an unusually high level of agreement this late in the term. Closely divided cases have more moving parts than unanimous opinions, so they tend to take longer to issue. In addition to the majority opinion, in a divided case, there may be multiple concurrences and dissents, with the different opinions responding to and criticizing each other in various ways, so it can take more back and forth before the justices are all ready to sign off on the opinions. The upshot of this is that the court typically issues more unanimous opinions early in the term, while a lot of the most contentious cases come down closer to the end of June. But this year, the court is still putting out a lot of unanimous opinions at the beginning of June. Out of the 43 decisions so far this term, 28 have been unanimous. That's 65%. Of course, this percentage is likely to drop as more divided decisions come down in the next few weeks, but the term is almost certain to end up with a higher than usual proportion of unanimous cases, which in recent years have made up closer to 45% of the court's cases. Some commentators have attributed this higher level of agreement to an effort by the court to avoid taking highly divisive cases while short of justice to avoid 4-4 splits. It remains to be seen whether it will continue next term now that the court is back at full strength after the confirmation of Justice Gorsuch. In the remainder of this episode, we're going to review two of the three non-unanimous decisions from the last few weeks, BNSF Railroad Co. v. Terrell and Impression Products Inc. v. Lexmark International Inc. Both of these decisions were issued on May 30th, and both were nearly unanimous, with only a partial dissent by a single justice. The third non-unanimous case, Cooper v. Harris, issued on May 22nd, was a more closely divided 5-3 decision. We'll be discussing Cooper next episode. Now let's dive right into the opinions. The first case is BNSF Railroad Co. v. Terrell. This is a procedural case that deals with a statute called the Federal Employers Liability Act, or FELA, and a concept called personal jurisdiction. On its surface, this is a dry technical case about civil procedure, but underneath the surface are deep questions about the ability of a court, as an instrument of state power, to assert its authority over particular people or entities and issue binding legal judgments against them. If a court has personal jurisdiction over a civil defendant, it can order that party to appear in court to defend itself, and if the defendant is a no-show, the court can rule against it by default. On the other hand, if a court has no personal jurisdiction over a defendant, it lacks the power to issue a judgment against it. This case is an action to recover damages for work-related injuries to two former employees of BNSF. The lawsuit was brought in Montana State Court under FELA, which makes railroads liable for their employees' on-the-job injuries. Importantly, neither of the injured employees lived, worked, or were injured in Montana, nor is BNSF headquartered or incorporated in Montana, though it does operate in the state. The plaintiffs argued that FELA gave the Montana courts personal jurisdiction over BNSF, because certain provisions of FELA first granted federal courts personal jurisdiction over railroads in any federal district where they are, quote, doing business, and second, FELA extended that personal jurisdiction from the federal courts to the state courts. The Montana Supreme Court agreed with plaintiffs, but the Supreme Court reversed in an 8-justice majority opinion written by Justice Ginsburg, holding that the Montana Supreme Court had misinterpreted FELA in both respects. First, the court said, the provision that plaintiffs construed as granting personal jurisdiction to federal courts wherever railroads do business was actually establishing venue. Venue is a distinct legal concept that refers to the geographic locations where a lawsuit can appropriately be brought. But the fact that venue could be appropriate in a particular judicial district doesn't mean that that court necessarily has jurisdiction over the parties. Second, the court said that the provision plaintiffs construed as extending the federal court's personal jurisdiction to the state courts was actually dealing with the entirely different concept of subject matter jurisdiction. This refers to the types of cases that a particular court is allowed to hear. Some types of federal claims, for example, patent infringement actions, can be brought exclusively in federal court. The FILA provision at issue, according to the Supreme Court, was simply making clear that FILA claims can be brought in either federal or state court. With the FILA theory of personal jurisdiction out of the way, the court considered whether the state court had personal jurisdiction under Montana law. But here the key question was whether this exercise of personal jurisdiction would exceed constitutional limits. If the injuries at issue were directly related to the railroad's actions in Montana, Montana courts would likely have what's known as specific personal jurisdiction over claims for those injuries. But because the injuries weren't related to the railroad's Montana activities, Montana courts would need to exercise what's known as general personal jurisdiction, that is, personal jurisdiction over a particular defendant for any claim regardless of where it arose. Unfortunately for the plaintiffs, the Supreme Court made short work of this theory, relying on a 2014 decision called Daimler AG v. Bauman, where the court made clear that state courts can only exercise general personal jurisdiction over a corporation in a state where it is, quote, at home, which basically means only the states where it is headquartered or incorporated. Neither is the case for BNSF in Montana, so there is no general personal jurisdiction. The end result is that the case is tossed back to the Montana state courts, but with the Montana Supreme Court's holding that there is personal jurisdiction over BNSF reversed. The court did note, however, that plaintiffs have also argued that BNSF consented to the jurisdiction of the Montana courts, but that the Montana Supreme Court didn't address this argument, so that theory is potentially still open to the plaintiffs. Absent that, the case will have to be dismissed for lack of jurisdiction. Justice Sotomayor wrote a separate opinion, concurring in part and dissenting in part. She agreed with the majority that FILA doesn't provide personal jurisdiction, making that portion of the decision unanimous. Where Sotomayor disagreed, however, was on the issue of general personal jurisdiction. Sotomayor rejects the court's limitation of general personal jurisdiction over a corporation to only those states where the corporation is headquartered or incorporated, and argues that general personal jurisdiction should be available in any state where a corporation has continuous and systematic contacts. Here, she echoes her solo concurrence in Daimler AG v. Bauman, where she disagreed with the majority's narrow view of general personal jurisdiction, although she came to the same result as the majority in that case. BNSF shows that Sotomayor intends to continue pushing for a broader approach to general personal jurisdiction, but with eight justices on the other side, it seems unlikely that she will make headway in the near future. This case was significant in that it was the first decision issued from the April oral argument session, which means it was the first decision in an argued case in which Justice Gorsuch participated. Gorsuch's role, however, was limited to joining an eight-justice majority, so it provides little insight into his legal views. The second near-unanimous case, also issued on May 30th, is Impression Products, Inc. v. Lexmark International, Inc. This was a case about the doctrine of patent exhaustion. What is patent exhaustion? A patent holder has a legal right to control the use of the patented invention and can prevent others from manufacturing or selling the patented invention without permission. But what control does the patent holder have over the use of a patented invention once a particular product covered by the patent has been legally sold? Normally, the answer is none. Once a patented product has been legally sold, whether by the patent owner itself or by someone licensed by the patent owner to sell the patent is exhausted with respect to that sale, and the patent owner cannot control how the purchaser uses it. The doctrine of patent exhaustion is the legal implementation of the common intuition that once you own something, it's yours to do with as you please, whether that means to sell it, to give it away, or to use it in a way that the seller didn't intend. With that in mind, let's turn to this case. Lexmark sells laser printers, but more importantly for this case, it sells the toner cartridges needed for those laser printers to operate. These toner cartridges contain proprietary software and are covered by various patents, meaning only Lexmark can manufacture a cartridge that works in a Lexmark printer. But empty Lexmark toner cartridges can be refilled and reused, so companies referred to as remanufacturers, including the petitioner in this case, Impression Products, purchase empty Lexmark cartridges, refill them, and then resell them to consumers. Lexmark is understandably unhappy about its new cartridge sales being undercut by these remanufacturers and sued Impression Products for patent infringement. At first glance, it would seem that the remanufacturers are in the clear under the doctrine of patent exhaustion. Once Lexmark sells a cartridge, its patent with respect to that cartridge is exhausted, and the customer is now in control and is free to sell the cartridge to a remanufacturer who can in turn refill and resell it. But Lexmark had two arguments why patent exhaustion shouldn't apply, at least to certain cartridges. First, some of Lexmark's toner cartridges were sold through what it refers to as its return program. Under this program, the customer receives a discount on the purchase of a cartridge, but must sign a contract agreeing to use the cartridge only once and not to transfer the empty cartridge to anyone other than Lexmark. Lexmark argued that under this contract, it never gave customers complete authority over the patented product, and therefore exhaustion shouldn't apply. Second, some of the cartridges were originally sold by Lexmark outside the U.S., but were then imported and resold inside the U.S. by Impression Products. This is important because patent law is territorial. A U.S. patent prohibits others from selling a patented product in the U.S., but the foreign sale of the product isn't affected unless the patent holder also obtains a patent from the relevant foreign patent office. If Lexmark's foreign sales of its cartridges aren't covered by its U.S. patents, then, Lexmark argues, these sales shouldn't exhaust the U.S. patent. The Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, this is a specialized court of appeals that hears patent appeals from district courts across the United States, agreed with Lexmark on both the return program cartridges and the foreign sales. The Supreme Court reversed the Federal Circuit on both theories. First, the court rejected the idea that a patent holder could use contracts to evade patent exhaustion. Patent exhaustion turns simply on the sale of the invention, not the terms the patent holder places on that sale. Although Lexmark might very well have valid breach of contract claims against its customers who sold their empty cartridges to remanufacturers, they no longer have any patent right over those cartridges. Of course, from Lexmark's perspective, the idea of bringing thousands of small-dollar lawsuits against its own customers is probably not very appealing, so without a patent claim against the remanufacturer, the customer agreement isn't worth much. Second, the court held that patent exhaustion applies equally to foreign sales. In 2013, the court dealt with a very similar issue in a case called Kurtzsang v. John Wiley & Sons. Kurtzsang dealt with copyrights rather than patents, but copyright law has a doctrine called first sale, which is directly analogous to patent exhaustion, and allows the legal owner of a copyrighted work to freely dispose of it. It's the first sale doctrine that makes used bookstores and libraries possible. In Kurtzsang, the court held that the first sale doctrine applies to lawful foreign sales of copyrighted works. In Impression Products v. Lexmark, the court held that just as with copyrighted works, it's the patent holder's decision to authorize the sale of the invention that triggers exhaustion, regardless of where that sale happens. Justice Ginsburg wrote a separate decision concurring in part and dissenting in part. Ginsburg agreed with the court with respect to the return program cartridges, but argued that foreign sales should not trigger patent exhaustion. Ginsburg dissented in the Kurtzsang case and continues to believe that foreign sales of copyrighted works should not trigger the first sale doctrine. But Ginsburg also argues that the result in this case does not directly follow from Kurtzsang for two reasons. One, the first sale doctrine is codified in the copyright statute, whereas exhaustion is a court-invented limitation on patents. And two, patents, unlike copyrights, are not harmonized across countries, and therefore there may be more reason to treat foreign conduct differently. Like Justice Sotomayor's partial dissent in BNSF, Ginsburg is all alone here. But unlike in BNSF, where the court's decision was ultimately rooted in the Constitution, here it is interpreting a statutory scheme. In cases like this, the court doesn't always have the last word. Congress is free to amend the statutes and does occasionally change the law in direct response to a Supreme Court decision. Having lost definitively at the Supreme Court, supporters of Lexmark's position may turn their attention to Congress. It remains to be seen whether Congress will address exhaustion in future patent legislation. Finally, there's a larger context surrounding this case. The court here overruled the Federal Circuit on both issues. Unlike the other federal courts of appeals, which hear appeals from a particular geographic jurisdiction, the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals is a specialized court that hears patent appeals from across the country. For many years, the Supreme Court was largely content to let the Federal Circuit be the final word on patent matters, and the Federal Circuit gained a reputation for being an extremely pro-patent court, routinely adopting interpretations of patent law that made patents easier to obtain and easier to enforce. But over the last decade or so, the Supreme Court has taken a much more active role reviewing Federal Circuit decisions, frequently reversing the Federal Circuit in a less pro-patent direction, and often unanimously or by a large margin. This decision is another example of that trend. And that brings us to the end of Episode 7. Links to resources related to this episode can be found in the show notes at countingto5.com. That's T-O and the number 5. Especially at this time of year, there's no shortage of interesting Supreme Court material to talk about. But as we close out the term and move into the summer, we want to know what you want to hear about. Which cases deserve a deep dive? What questions about the court would you like answered? Feedback of any kind is very welcome and will influence our coverage going forward. You can leave a comment on the show notes post at countingto5.com or on the Counting to 5 Facebook page, tweet at countingto5, or send an email to mike@countingto5.com. You can call and leave questions and comments on the Counting to 5 voicemail line at 774-226-8685. That's 774-2-COUNT-5. I look forward to hearing from you. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to Counting to 5 to make sure you don't miss future episodes. If Counting to 5 is not available in your podcast app of choice, please let us know and we'll do what we can to get it listed. Now's the part where I ask for your help. Our listener numbers are still fairly low right now, but I'm sure there are a lot more people out there who would appreciate what we're doing here. I need your help to spread the word. Please follow Counting to 5 on Facebook or Twitter, and share and retweet episodes to your friends and followers. If you know any lawyers, law students, college students thinking about law school, or just people interested in law, government, politics, or current events, please let them know about this podcast. More listeners means more feedback, and more feedback makes for a better podcast. Finally, researching, writing, recording, and editing Counting to 5 is a time-consuming process. If you value the content we're putting out, please consider supporting this podcast financially. Visit Counting to 5's Patreon page, where you can pledge as little as $1 a month. Every little bit helps. In our next episode, we're going to look at the court's decision in Cooper v. Harris, a North Carolina case about racial gerrymandering. I hope you'll join me. Thank you for listening. This has been Counting to 5.